Well, let me ask you a question this morning. Why do you think it is that not more people are Christians than there currently are? I guess you could point to many reasons. Some have just never heard the Christian message in language they can understand. Some don't believe in God. They've never looked at the historical evidence for Jesus being God as he declared he was. Some have specific questions, maybe, which prevent them from looking further. It's one of how could a good God allow the suffering that's in the world? Hasn't science replaced God? They're honest questions that they mull over. But I put it to you that at least a proportion of people don't believe because they fear what it would mean for them if they did come to believe. They have a deep-seated fear that essentially Christianity is bad news. They harbor a suspicion that God is out to spoil anything that might be considered good, enjoyable, fun, or otherwise good for them in life. They're happy with life as it is, and they don't want to risk some heavenly meddling entity, interferer, mucking things up. And of course, when we begin to think in those terms, it's not only non-Christians who think in that way. It's really a question for all of us. Do we believe that God has our best interests at heart? Do we believe that God has the best interests of those close to us, people that we love, at heart? When life isn't working out as we hoped it would, when God doesn't seem to be giving us what we thought we needed, when life seems around us to be on the verge of crashing down, when we want something and nothing comes of it, when we pray and we can't see an answer to our prayers, does God really have our best interests at heart? And today's passage answers that question because it shows us that to live under the rule of the king who God has appointed in this world is always the best place to be. It's the most wonderful, it's the best, it's the most satisfying place to be. And to live life outside of the kingdom where this king rules will always be second best or worse. Now, if you were here last week, you'll know that we've begun looking at this book, 1 Kings. We looked at chapters 1 and 2. We saw how Solomon was established on the throne of Israel as David's successor. And the question now as we get into chapter 3 is, yeah, but what kind of king will he be? And the chief answer is, he will be a wise king who will rule for the best of his people always. Notice just a few different things. First of all, the king is given wisdom by God. In chapter 3, verses 1 to 3, we're given some details about Solomon. I think it's a little bit hard to know how to read them, but I'm picking up as I read it that this is a mixed picture. So he's not an unblemished king. He's not a perfect king. There are some downsides. In fact, these downsides will turn out to be major cracks in the kingdom later on. And before we come on to all the good things, the writer just sends us a signal that even Solomon has feet of clay, okay? So he's not perfect before we go overboard on him. But nonetheless, it is a positive reading. If you have a look at verse 3 of chapter 3, Solomon showed his love for the Lord by walking according to the statutes of his father David, except that he offered sacrifices and burned incense on the high places. So this is basically going to be a positive reading, but with some cautions and caveats as well. Now, here is Solomon. He loves the Lord. He wants to do the right thing. So verse 4, he goes to Gibeon to offer sacrifices, for that was the most important high place. And Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. We're not told what they were, but let's just suppose they were bulls or cows. I don't know how big your herd is at home, but here are 1,000 bulls being led in to be sacrificed on the altar at Gibeon. And while he's there, it obviously lasts more than one day because he has a sleep, and God comes to him in a dream. And here you see in verse 5, at Gibeon the Lord appeared to Solomon during the night in a dream, and God said to him, "Ask for whatever you want me to give you." Do you think this is a God who's out to spoil life? What an offer from the person who runs this universe. Ask whatever you want, and I will give it to you. It is this incredibly generous, open-handed offer by God. And amazingly, before you think this is one of those things, oh yeah, that was Solomon back then, we live now, 2016, do you know what? Jesus actually says just about the same words to us as well. Come to God and ask for whatever you want, and I will give it to you. You remember how Jesus said, ask and it will be given to you? And he also said, you don't receive because you don't ask, later on in the New Testament. Here is the God who is good, who is willing to give. He is a generous God. He's open-handed. Like any good father, he's not going to give us absolutely anything we want, which would destroy us within minutes. He'll only give it to us if it's for our best, because he wants our best. It's a great incentive for prayer. And when Jesus says, ask and it will be given to you, he's not joking. He really does mean it. In fact, it's no wonder that Solomon is absolutely filled with thanksgiving. Just look how he replies, verse 6 in the dream. Solomon answered, you have shown great kindness to your servant, my father David, because he was faithful to you and righteous and upright in heart. You have continued this great kindness to him and have given him a son to sit on his throne this very day. So he realizes how kind God is. And now we come to the business end. How's he going to answer? What will Solomon ask for? One thing, whatever you want. What's it going to be? Verse 7. Now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of my father David. But I am only a little child. I don't know how to carry out my duties as king. Your servant is here among the people you have chosen, a great people too numerous to count or number. So give your servant a discerning heart, a heart of wisdom, to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. For who is able to govern this great people of yours? What will Solomon ask for? It's an amazing answer, isn't it? Actually, I remember some years ago, I was doing a kids' slot in church, and I said to the kids, okay, hands up, kids, you tell me if I could give you anything in the whole world. If you're allowed one thing, put your hand up and tell me what it is. What would you like? Absolutely anything. So most of them, of course, say things that they've seen in a shop somewhere. I'd like a new toy car, or I'd like a new computer game, or one or two of them said, I'd like a new brother or sister, or, you know, that sort of thing. And there was one boy there. I said, Charlie, what would you like? This wasn't our son, by the way. It was different. I said, Charlie, what would you like? He said, I'd like wisdom. I thought, ah, oh, you've read this passage before, haven't you? He was taking after Solomon. And it pleased God. God said to him, because you didn't ask for a new computer game, or a new toy car, or a new real car, or a jet plane, or lifelong holidays, or whatever. Because you asked for wisdom, I'm actually going to bless you with a whole heap of other things that you haven't asked for. And the point here is that the wisdom that Solomon is about to display comes from heaven above. It comes from God himself. And it's worth bearing that in mind. Now, just have a look on, so I can show you what I mean. In chapter 4, and verse 30. Can you just flick over a page? Chapter 4, verse 30. And look at the wisdom that God gives to this man. Chapter 4, verse 30. Solomon's wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the men of the East. And it was greater than all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than any other man, including Ethan the Ezrahite. He was wiser than He-Man. He was wiser than Calcol. And I'll tell you what he says, you're not going to believe this, he's actually wiser than Dada. You know, no one's wiser than Dada, but Solomon was. And his fame spread to all the surrounding nations. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs numbered 1,005. He described plant life from the cedar of Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of walls. He taught about animals and birds and reptiles and fish, and men of all nations came to listen to Solomon's wisdom, sent by all the kings of the world who had heard of this wisdom. So here is a man who is absolutely brilliant. He's the Christian version of Leonardo da Vinci, David Attenborough, John Lennon, and Steve Irwin, all rolled into one. He is the original Renaissance man. And it would be easy to think, because of Solomon's brilliance, he's just the sort of person you have to stand back and admire in life. You know, that kind of thing. But I think the really significant thing is verse 29, not verse 30, verse 29. God gave Solomon wisdom and very great insight and a breadth of understanding as measureless as the sand on the seashore. This wisdom that makes Solomon so brilliant comes from God. And because it comes from God, it's actually available to ordinary people like you and me. That same God is willing and wants to give us wisdom as well. In fact, it's the plea of the Bible that we seek wisdom. Here's the writer of the book of Proverbs. Choose my instruction instead of silver, knowledge rather than choice gold. You know how like you might wander past a jeweler and think, oh, fancy that. Look at that in there, that diamond encrusted ring, or got a few rubies or whatever. The writer of the book of Proverbs says, if you know what's good for you, have that same desire for this book, for the Bible, for God's wisdom. In fact, have a greater desire, for this is more valuable than what you'll see in the jeweler's shop. It really is. He's not pulling a fast one. It is literally more valuable. I'll tell you what, it's a good deal cheaper as well. Now, this is available to us. The Bible says that the beginning of wisdom is fearing the Lord. So if you're here this morning and you're not sure where you stand with God, why don't you pray a prayer and say, God, if you are there, if you exist, please make me wise and help me to come to know you. The beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. That means taking God seriously, actually listening to him and learning. And you can pray that kind of prayer if you're not a Christian, to ask God to help you understand if he's there and what he's like. But then, once we come to believe in him and follow him, we can gain wisdom from him. And we do that by seeking wisdom that is in the scriptures, by reading the scriptures and asking God to make us wise as we do so. So I'll just give you a couple of examples, because in the book of Proverbs, which comes a little bit later on in the middle of the Old Testament, a great book of wisdom, some of it was written by King Solomon. So let's learn from King Solomon this morning, just a couple of things. I'll give you a couple of examples. Proverbs 11 verse 14. Proverbs 11 verse 14 says this, "For lack of guidance, a nation falls, but many advisers make victory sure." Okay? So for lack of guidance, a nation falls, but many advisers make victory sure. And what Solomon is saying with the wisdom of God is that if you want to make wise decisions in life, make sure you ask for advice. If you just make all the decisions yourself, you are living a very narrow viewpoint and you're exposing yourself to folly. Why not ask other people around you? At the end of the day, it's your life. It's your decision. You don't have to follow their advice. You make the decision, not them. But if you don't seek their advice, then you are exposing yourself to making foolish decisions. So if I get engaged or change job to something significantly different to what I'm in already, change of hours, or I move house, move location, move country, if I don't ask someone around me for advice, what do you think about this? What do you think would be the pros and cons? I'm a fool in that way. And I have to say, in all humility, because I probably would have done the same, I've seen people do this time and again. And the reason they do is because our society is such an individual society. Outside of a Christian community, you wouldn't think of asking advice. Why would I? It's my life, not yours. You know, that kind of thing. It's only within a Christian community you would think of saying, have you got any thoughts on this? Can you see any pluses or minuses in that way? I remember once driving around to someone's house, and when I got there, and I knew them sort of fairly well, but I hadn't been around for a while, there was a for sale sign up outside the house, and I thought, oh, that's funny. They must have got the wrong side of the drive. And I went inside, and I said, oh, they put a for sale sign up outside your house. And they said, oh, that's because we're selling the house. Oh, that would be. I said, really? I didn't know that. Oh, yeah, we're thinking of moving out to this place here. And in fact, we've had an offer which we've accepted. So I thought, oh, well, there's no point saying anything now. They've accepted it. So they did, I must admit. I did have my thoughts on the inside. And we talked about it, and I wrote them an email. Anyway, that was fine. They disregarded that and did their thing. Later on, I thought, well, I better make up and I'll go and see them in the new place. So once they moved into the new place, I went around for a cup of coffee. And they were just talking about how they might serve in church life. And they said, oh, we'd really like to host a Bible study. It'd be good to get back into that. And then one of them turned to the other and said, do you think people would come out this far? It's like, I could have told you that beforehand. Now you're stuck living out here. And that's fine if you want to have a ministry out there and reach people around. But that wasn't what they were thinking. But they hadn't thought about, would people drive out from here to there? And that would have been something they could have thought about beforehand. They may still have decided to go ahead, but at least you're going ahead with your eyes open in that kind of way. So, for lack of guidance, a nation falls, but many advisors make victory sure. Or the next verse, chapter 11 of Proverbs, this is, verse 15. He who puts up security for another will surely suffer. He who puts up security for another will surely suffer. So, as a Christian, you are more than welcome to lend your money to other people. And that may be a good thing to do. But God says, only do it if you're prepared to lose the money. He who puts up security for another will surely suffer. I've lost count of the number of times that people have lent money to someone else in church life or outside, and then it's gone down the gurgler, and then they feel upset because their money's been, it hasn't been repaid. And I think the Bible's emphasis would be, it is your mistake more than the person that lost it. If you want to lend it, that's great. That's fine. But only do it with your eyes open. Don't lend it unless you're prepared to lose it in that way. He who puts up security for another will surely suffer. And a whole variety of other wisdom to help us get through life making the best decisions. If we want to seek God's wisdom, let's open the Bible, read it, and ask God to change us as we do so. Would you like to be a better spouse, a better parent, a better parent-in-law, a better employee? Please give me the wisdom to become that person. God is the source of wisdom. He's longing to give it. The question for us is, are we longing to receive it? Then secondly, see that the king's wisdom was displayed in his rule. The scene ends we're in chapter 3 now, 1 Kings 3. It ends in verse 15 with this rather tantalizing statement that Solomon awoke and he realized it had been a dream. I don't know if you've had those sort of dreams and you wake up, oh, rats, it was a dream. And you sort of think, oh, that's a shame. It would have been nice if this was reality. And then we find out that it was God working through this dream. Okay, God can work through anything. He was working through this dream. And it actually was reality, even though it was a dream. And the wisdom that God has given, which presumably was displayed in countless ways during Solomon's reign, is then exemplified in this one example here of the two prostitutes. And it's this extraordinary wisdom that God has given Solomon. Two prostitutes come to him. They're arguing over the identity of a child. They don't do DNA testing back then. And they're both saying, this baby belongs to me. And it's one of those instances when I would have thought from the outside, Solomon, probably to begin with, thinks, oh, how am I going to deal with this? Two women, they both claim to be mothers, a baby that looks half like one, half like the other, I can't tell. What are we going to do here? And Solomon hits on the answer straight away. He says, it's quite simple. Give me a sword, we'll cut the baby in two, and we'll give half each. It's the only fair way to proceed. And of course, the real mother says, oh, it's all right, you keep the baby. The false mother says, no, that's right, half each. You know, chop the baby in two, I'm happy with half. And Solomon says, well, there's your answer. The woman who's happy to give the baby away because she wants the baby's life to be preserved is the real mother. And the people, of course, are, my goodness, where did he get that kind of wisdom from? It's absolutely extraordinary. And it's a wisdom that extends to the whole way he governs the kingdom. So in chapter 4, you get these list of names. Chapters 4, 1 to 6, he has his chief officials. And Solomon delegates the running of the kingdom to these people. Someone is in charge of each aspect of the running of the kingdom, presumably. And it gives the impression of a kingdom which is well administered. Verse 7 to 19, there are these 12 district governors whose job it is to supply the royal household. That is the civil service that keeps the country running. It's estimated there's 4,000 to 5,000 people in that household. And in verses 22 and 23, you see the daily provisions that are needed to keep the show on the road. Have a look down. Solomon's daily provisions were 30 cores of fine flour, 60 cores of meal, 10 head of stall-fed cattle. You know, you go to an expensive restaurant and it's grass, hand-fed, that's what it is there. Then there's 20 of pasture-fed cattle, that's free-range, and 100 sheep and goats, as well as deer, venison, gazelles, roebucks, and choice fowl. Quite nice to work in Solomon's kingdom, do you think? Good place to be. Okay, here everything is taken care of. And it's a picture that to live in Solomon's country under a ruler that has this kind of wisdom, where God is blessing it, is the best place to be. Now, in our world, there is always a suspicion that people in power are not to be trusted. And maybe understandably so, because many times they do have their snouts in the trough and everyone has their vested interests. But there's that sort of underlying suspicion that all people, are, you know, they're never impartial. And I suppose we look overseas and there are corrupt countries and regimes. But even in a country like New Zealand, we acknowledge that no one is perfect, and politicians and the judiciary and business leaders and whatever, no one's perfect. Everyone makes mistakes, and a few people worse than that. Here is someone with absolute power as the monarch of his country who rules with a wonderful justice. Would it not be great to live in Solomon's kingdom? And the amazing privilege that we have is to live under a king who is far, far better even than Solomon. Even he had feet of clay, as we'll discover in a couple of weeks' time. Jesus Christ, on the other hand, was perfect in every way. And in the New Testament, we read these amazing words that in the Lord Jesus Christ, one greater than Solomon is here. So if you come to live in Jesus' kingdom, as a member of his kingdom, you're entrusting yourself to a king who is absolutely perfect. And that perfection of wisdom is shown in, many ways, but here are a couple. It's displayed in his judgments. You think of some of the instances in Jesus' life, and I remember looking at these really early on in my Christian life, and I was amazed back then, and I'm still just as amazed today when I read them. You see what Jesus was like as a person, and you see the incredible wisdom that God gave to him. There were many times in Jesus' life when he was under the most extreme pressure. And there was that time, for example, when the Pharisees came to him, and you can imagine them there, sort of, you know, dark glasses and notebook in hand, taking notes. And Jesus knows that if he says one wrong thing, if he says one thing that is out of place, they'll put him in chains and take him away. And they come to him in this way, and they say to him, "Is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" It's a trick question. If he says yes, then he's supporting a brutal emperor against his own people. If he says no, then he's defying the rule of the land. So either way, he's done for. And Jesus says, on the spur of the moment, he says, "Has anyone got a coin here?" And he takes a coin. "Can you just tell me whose head is on that coin?" And they say, "Well, it's Caesar's." He says, "Well, there's your answer. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and give to God what is God's." And we're told the people couldn't say anything. And every time he is able to think on a sixpence and come up with the one answer that can confound his critics, it is a measure of brilliance that the like of it, we just could not even compare in that way. It's wisdom in his judgments, and it's wisdom in his administration. Proverbs chapter 8 personifies wisdom. Says that wisdom was a person, and it's really speaking in its fulfillment about Jesus Christ. He is that person. He is wisdom in human form. He is the person in whom is stored all of God's treasures of wisdom. And that is why heaven will be so good. For in heaven, this King Jesus will be ruling perfectly. Everything will be governed and administered fairly. There will be no injustice at all. In fact, there'll be no wrong done at all. In heaven, the little people won't get left out. Everyone will get a fair share in that way. And the truth is that you and I on earth, we struggle to govern our own lives properly. Can't even govern my own life, let alone other people's. And sometimes we administer our own affairs with sad and far-reaching consequences. Now, here is a person, Jesus, who can govern not just himself perfectly, not just a business or even a small country perfectly. He can govern the whole of the created order absolutely flawlessly. So praise God for Jesus Christ, our wise and wonderful ruler. And so thirdly, just as we wrap up, we see that the king's wisdom benefited the people. Of course, how could they not benefit from this, living under this sort of rule? Who wouldn't? And look at how the people have described. Can you just have a look at chapter 4 and verse 20? Chapter 4 and verse 20. The people of Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand on the seashore. They ate, they drank, and they were happy. What were the people like who lived under this rule? First of all, they were numerous. They are growing in number. And that growing in number was in fulfillment of the promises that God had made earlier in the Bible, first to Abraham and then repeated to others. And it was a sign of excitement that these promises are coming to fulfillment. And it reminds us that when we get to heaven, there will be many, 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 many people there. There will be more people in heaven than you can shake a stick at, which you just need to remember when you live in the West in the 21st century and Christianity has gone rather out of fashion. Don't worry, God's not out of fashion. There are millions of other people in the world coming to faith in Jesus. And when we get to heaven, it won't be the case that sort of, you know, only a quarter of the seats are filled. And it's kind of, oh, you know, it's not quite the sort of party I thought it would be. God is bringing people all over the world into his kingdom. The people were numerous. Secondly, the people were fulfilled. They ate, they drank, and they were happy. These people who lived under Solomon were content. And why not? They have got the good life. They've got the prosperous life. The king is well looked after. But it's not the kind of thing where the king and his cohorts take all the goodies. This isn't a sort of Mugabe-type regime where the leaders race around in 4x4s while the rest of the people starve. No, here Solomon is treated like a king, but he also cares for the people. The people don't go short, they are looked after too. In fact, it's because the king is treated like a king that they do well. You get the distinct impression that if Solomon is not on the throne, then things will go downhill for the people as well. It's because he is the king that they prosper with no one resisting him and mucking it up. And that's how heaven will be like too. Many times Jesus pictured heaven like a feast. In fact, when we come to that dinner and invitation week, I don't know which passage I'll choose, but it'll be one that has heaven like a feast. What is heaven like? Many times Jesus said, it's like a banquet, it's like a feast, it's like a party, it's like the place you want to be at. Whatever you think is wonderful, that's what it'll be like. And just because there are tons of people there, don't think of it as being somehow sort of impersonal. Heaven will be wonderful. There'll be food and drink, which is unlimited. There'll be great company. And best of all, the king will be there on his throne. And even at the moment, if you're a Christian, you get a tiny, tiny taste of what it'll be like. It's true that being a Christian introduces difficulties into life that you wouldn't have had if you weren't a Christian. But I don't think any of us who've been a Christian for any length of time would then say we would want to swap it. In fact, you know as well as I do that although being a Christian can make life more complicated at times and sometimes harder, we wouldn't swap it for the world. Because even now we get a taste of the joy, of the happiness, of the contentment that comes from being reconciled to God and being part of his family that extends across the world. There's a richness to living life now that we wouldn't swap. And so even for Solomon, what he had here was just the crumbs that fall from the table of what we will have one day in heaven. The people who live in this kingdom are numerous. They're fulfilled, as we will one day totally be, and they live in safety. Have a look at verse 24-25. For Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms west of the river, from Tipsah to Gaza, and he had peace on all sides. During Solomon's lifetime, Judah and Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, lived in safety. each man under his own vine and fig tree. Solomon had 4,000 stalls for chariot horses and 12,000 horses. During Solomon's reign, there was peace in the kingdom. And for Christians who live in parts of the world where they're being brutalized this morning, this is music to their ears. One day when they get to heaven, there will be total peace. They'll be able to live in freedom and safety. We're not under the same pressure that they are, but even we know what it is like to live in a spiritual war, which we certainly are in the middle of. And to be a Christian takes effort day after day after day. You take some hits. You do things wrong. Sometimes you do really silly things. Sometimes it is just hard work following the king in this world. But when we get to the promised land, ruled by our great king, where his rule is unchallenged, there will be genuine, heartfelt safety and peace. And for the first time in our whole lives, we'll be able to relax totally, let our guard down, and just enjoy life in the kingdom. And the safety comes because of the strength of the king. He has an army here of 4,000 chariot horses, 4,000 stalls and 12,000 horses. That's to keep the people safe. In the new creation, where it is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords who reigns over all, he won't need an army, for with his smallest finger, he can keep entire control over everything. Not in a restrictive way, except insofar as evil will be totally defeated and will be unable to raise its head again. It's a wonderful, wonderful picture. So back to where we started. Do you think that God has your best interests at heart? And the best interests of those who you love? Well, when providing a king for us, such as King Jesus, do you think that we should not trust him? Do you think that we should not ask for wisdom, ask for the humility to live under him? Instead of drawing back from him, as perhaps we have when we think about our lives, maybe we should draw towards him more, embrace him more fully. For at the end of the day, he's offering us a place in his kingdom. And he's guaranteed for us through his death and resurrection and ascension a future in that kingdom. Here is God who loves us so much, cares for us, and only ever has our best intention, our best interests at heart.